If you were black in Kansas City 100 years ago, where could you go to be buried? Even 75 years ago, what funeral home could offer you embalming and memorial services, and how could you afford it? I'm Jabulani LaFall, and in the second half of today's Central Standard, a look at the history of African-American funeral homes. But first, a look at how black history is being preserved in our region. We welcome Dr. Doretha Williams, the new executive director of the Black Archives of Mid-America. She was a recent guest on KC Currents, where she confessed how the rich cultural artifacts in the archives can be highly distracting in her new job as executive director.
Yeah, I get in the archives sometimes and get to digging through things, and that causes a problem sometimes because I'm, you know, needing to be working here.
We'll hear Dr. Williams' goals, and we'd like to hear your feelings about Black History Month as we kick off the shortest month of the year. That's on Central Standard after this hour's news. Good morning, Kansas City. By the age of 27, Horace Peterson had become a walking archive. He spent his remaining years mentally filing away anecdotes, collecting keepsakes from his family's move from Tulsa, Oklahoma to Kansas City. Later in life, these stories became legend. These keepsakes became valuable artifacts, and documents became the founding father of the Black Archives of Mid-America, which will continue to carry on his legacy when it reopens its doors this summer. This is Central Standard. I'm Jabulani LaFall. Joining us now is Topeka-born KU graduate Dr. Doretha Williams. She joins us today as the new executive director of the Black Archives of Mid-America, located just north of the historic 18th and Vine District, the local bastion of living, breathing history. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Good morning.
Now, tell us about the Black Archives of Mid-America. Give us a little primer.
The Black Archives of Mid-America was founded by Horace Peterson, as you stated, in 1974. And his goal was to collect the history of African Americans in Kansas City through photographs, artifacts, whatever the community deemed important to remember African American history in this region. Right now we're working on reopening in June 16th, actually 2012. We're rehousing the collection as well as building out a wonderful exhibit titled "My Eyes No Longer Blind." "My Eyes No Longer Blind" is a title of a line in one of Langston Hughes' poems, and basically by naming the exhibit "My Eyes No Longer Blind," we're making sure that the community knows the rich history of African Americans in Kansas City.
I was going to ask you about that name and why you chose it to represent the entire permanent collection.
Right. Actually, the title was selected before I came on board, but as soon as I heard it, I was like, yeah, that's a great title, because it does. It shows that there is a history of African Americans in the Kansas City, greater Kansas City area, but also the region of the Central Plains, which sometimes is left out of the greater narrative of African American history in this country. So we're making sure that people who come to visit Kansas City can come to the archive and see that exhibit and see the names of our local heroes, as well as go into the archive and pull the photographs and personal letters and papers of some of our great people in the city.
Can you help us distinguish what an archive is versus a library collection or versus a museum?
Right. The Black Archives of Mid-America will have several layers. But the archive is a collection basically of manuscript collection. So we will specialize in collecting personal papers, photos, different correspondence from families or individuals in the city. And people in the community can come and request that information to do research. We have scholars who come in to do research where they're writing research papers. Graduate students come in. We have people who know that their family's material is housed there. So they may want to come in and say, oh, I know my great aunt's papers, maybe Horace Peterson had that, several years ago. So they may want to come in and read up on their own family history. So we're basically really concentrating on the collection, manuscripts, photographs, and those personal papers.
Speaking of Horace Peterson, you are personally not unlike Horace Peterson in that collectibles enthralled and inspired you from an early age. Tell us about that.
Yes. Well, it really started out even before I went to college, but I was really interested in my grandparents' life. My grandfather was born and raised in Sunflower County, Mississippi, and migrated to Kansas City back in the 30s. He's actually still living. He's 99 years old, so it's beautiful. But I've been recording oral histories of my family for years now. And then when I went off to college at Fisk University, I worked in the Special Collections Library and worked under the great Beth House, who's a wonderful name at Fisk University. But I really enjoyed looking at those collections, so much so that I was often told to go back to work because I would be digging in the photographs and the personal papers.
Right. But you mentioned on an earlier appearance on Casey Currents that there's so many fascinating artifacts and items that you can get wrapped up in it and can take you away from your job, even now.
Even now. In fact, a couple came in yesterday and dropped off a kind of a Tupperware, one of those large Tupperware tubs full of letters from a black family, just a collection of correspondence, maybe starting in 1940, maybe ending around 1947. And it was awesome. And I found myself, I put the white gloves on and I just jumped in reading these this collection of personal correspondence. And it can really pull you in because it takes you to a different time. Young people today, do you know about sending a telegram, you know, to have a discussion?
Probably not.
It's like old school texting, you know. So just looking at that, the way people corresponded, the way people got their thoughts across and what they deemed important.
Yeah, back then people actually laughed out loud.
Right.
They didn't text that they were
right.
Laughing out loud.
Exactly.
Doretha, what is this research of artifacts and history and place and sense of time, these letters? Tell us about where we are now. What does it tell us about where we are now?
Well, some of the letters that I just went through it briefly yesterday, but some of the letters reflect the economy of the time. We're coming out of the Great Depression, and some of the members of the family were looking for jobs, and a couple of the women in the family had migrated to Chicago, and someone else is in New York as well. That I got a brief glance at that letter as well. So they were on the move to find employment and really trying to find a way to take care of themselves financially and find work. And when I read that, I thought to myself, wow, that's not unlike today as our economy is at this time and people looking for work. So it really shows that everyday life of African Americans during that time period, looking for work, looking a way to support themselves, keeping in touch with family, moving about, and the patterns of migration that were going on in the 40s. So it's not unlike today. I mean, the correspondence was basically this family trying to stick together, trying to make their lives work, trying to find something good in their lives and moving through their lives. So a very personal look at the family.
You mentioned going through these artifacts and getting caught up, swept
right.
up, putting on your white gloves and just right. diving in and maybe getting away from some of the more mundane administrative activities involved in being the executive director of the Black Archives of Mid-America.
Right.
But what are your favorite types of items there in the archives? Are they letters? Are they artifacts? Is it old signage? What really gets your white gloves tingling?
I really enjoy looking at those items that that kind of show things we don't do anymore. Like I said, the telegraph, looking at the telegrams and maybe the way we corresponded back in the day. But I really love, and this is kind of going back to my young girly days, but really like the photos of the glamorous women back in the 20s, 30s, and 40s, and how glamorous they looked in their gowns and, doing...
Are you over at the Black Archives playing dress up?
Unfortunately, we don't have collections of gowns in there, but I really like to look at those fabulous women and how stylish they were and how poised they looked in those photographs. But yeah, anything like that, and really just looking at modes of communication back in the 20s, 30s, and 40s, and how we got our ideas across and reading old letters and how people used to greet each other, salutations, dear sister, you know, things that we don't really talk like that anymore. And I don't know folks who really actually correspond via letter anymore, but just really looking at those ways that are kind of outdated, but I think are really special in just historically.
I use the words fort with and yeah. fortnight every single day.
Right.
You're listening to Central Standard on 89.3 KCUR, streaming live on KCUR.org. Stay tuned for the second half of our show today when we'll be discussing the history of African-American funeral homes. Our current guest is Dr. Doretha Williams, the new executive director of the Black Archives of Mid-America. We're discussing her goals for the archives, her passion for history, and the preservation of the historical artifacts of the region. Kansas City, today is the first day of Black History Month. How do you feel about Black History Month? Is it inadequate in highlighting what really are American contributions, or is it necessary to continue to celebrate a rich cultural separate heritage in the month of February? Give us a call at 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888, or shoot us an email at centralstandard@kcur.org. You can also tweet at KCURCST, and Facebook is also an option. How do you feel about Black History Month, Doretha Williams? What are your memories of Black History Month as a kid, and bring us forward to how you feel about it now?
Right. Well, as a child, I remember being in grade school, and every Black History Month, we'd do some sort of Black History skit, and I was always Harriet Tubman. there was another young gentleman. I remember his name was Kevin. I won't give a last name, but I want to call him out. But his name was Kevin. He was really tall, so he was always Abraham Lincoln. And I remember turning to him in first grade and go, "I'm always Harriet Tubman." He said, "I'm always, you know, Abraham Lincoln." But there was one time where we did some scene of we were supposedly enslaved, and so we had to escape, and we actually crawled under some set of tables. I'm not quite sure what my teacher was thinking, but we did something like that. So my memory starts very young, and as an African American young woman, I think most people do have that type of memory, those real early times. In attending an African-American church, Second Baptist in Topeka, Kansas, growing up with African-American History Month skits and plays, and really having it instilled in us that it's an important thing to celebrate. And as a grown woman and looking back and thinking about Black History Month, you know, Black History Month was founded to combat that systematic removal of African Americans from history, you know, making sure that there's no pride and no joy in being African American. So that is the purpose of African American History Month. So I think it's still very important. And we can talk about the issues of it should be every day. And I do believe it should be an everyday experience. African American history is American history.
We're living African American history right now as we speak. We're going to go to Bruce in KC. Bruce, welcome to Central Standard.
Hey, Javelani, it's wonderful being on your show. I listen to you all the time.
Thank you very much, sir.
Yeah, here's my question. We recently, and I think it's gone already, the America I Am exhibit at the Union Station.
Right.
And I wanted to guess commentator had a chance to visit that exhibit, and if she did, how do you feel it fits within the Black Archives experience?
Well, he's referring to the America I Am exhibit that Tavis Smiley brought through. We had Tavis on Central Standard to talk about the African-American heritage and had him address some of the criticisms of the exhibit itself about its lack of local resonance, or maybe it's overstepping about 30 years of history between the Civil Rights Bill and between the modern era of achievements in African-American history. And what did you think of it? We'll give you a chance to.
Okay. Yeah, I went to the America I Am exhibit at least three times because it was humongous. For those who did go, I enjoyed looking at some of the pieces and the collection. I think what I would have wanted to see would be a little bit more programming, public programming around the exhibit, and maybe taking a part of the exhibit, say the section on African American religion or African American experience in religion in the United States, and then having individuals go to see that, and then having a more local history after that, you know, pulling pieces from the exhibit. I think I'm speaking of someone who does public programming and things like that, but making sure that it's not just a very large exhibit that, you know, people have to try to take in a couple hours, but making sure that it's relevant and resonates with the patrons who do go to see it.
We're here with Dorotha Williams, the new executive director for the Black Archives of Mid-America. We're talking about her goals at the Black Archives up in the 18th and Vine District and a larger theme of Black History Month. Do you believe Black History Month is still necessary? 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. You can also email us in at centralstandard@kcur.org. As we open this up to listeners, we pose it to you. What should the role of Black history be going forward? What role do you see yourself and the Black Archives playing in that greater discussion, Dorotha
right.
Williams?
Well, the plan for the Black Archives is to become that anchor in the African American community, in the Kansas City community as well, that place where we talk about the issues facing the African American community. We want to be that place where we have those intellectual discussions, those debates, those workshops, those things that will bring the narrative of African American history in Kansas City to the region. So that's what we're looking at when we're doing our public programming. So we actually have a great program coming up following the screening of Freedom Is Now, Emil Cleaver's documentary. We'll be hosting a panel discussion with members of Freedom Inc. Following Saturday, February 25th, from noon to 2:30. So
I believe we have Mr. Cleaver coming on the show to discuss
documentary.
Yes,
wonderful
well.
Documentary, by the way. So we definitely want to be that spot where that conversation, where people take part in that conversation, that debate.
What segments of the community are you targeting?
Right.
With the Black Archives.
We're definitely targeting a handful of communities, but our first and foremost right now, we really want to get a hold of the young people. And we hosted one of our first high school programs with a class from Sumner, and we had them screen pieces of Freedom Is Now documentary, and then also the 18th and Vine documentary, A People's Journey, and they answered some essay questions and had discussions. So we're really, that's one key community we're trying to reach, the young people, because they need to know that the Black Archives exists, and as they grow older and become more part of history, that, you know, they will be the folks who will be supporting the Black Archives, and they need to know their history. We're also targeting our elders in the community. We want to bring them back to the archive. I've met with several community historians, and they say the same thing. You know, Horace Peterson had me doing this, and I worked with him to do this and that. And so they're really excited that the Black Archives will open again. We're also targeting our scholars and historians who will be coming through Kansas City to do research on Black history in Kansas City. And then we'll have adult programs where we do workshops for folks who want to do oral history, genealogy, family research. So hands-on workshops as well as lectures and discussions.
So as Walbo Dean would say, you're giving it a wide berth of subject matter.
Yes. You know,
cutting yourself a wide swath
subject
matter to tackle. We're talking Black Archives. What does it mean to the community, the Black Archives of Mid-America? We have the executive director of the Black Archives, Dorotha Williams, here in the studio. We're also talking about the relevance and the ongoing relevance of Black History Month. Do you feel it's still relevant? Do you feel it's still necessary? 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. You can also hit us up at Facebook or centralstandard@kcur.org. We have Phil in Shawnee. Phil, welcome to Central Standard.
Morning, sir. My comment is that we do not need to continue to emphasize one nationality in America as a month, such as Native American Month, Black America Month. If we put it in the history books and is taught as American history, instead of just dividing the country the way we are divided now into nationalities for every month of the year.
Thank you very much, Phil. I believe we're one nationality American, but you know what he means, ethnic
right.
groups. What do you say to critics, Doretha, on either side? One school of thought being, if we incorporated what was really American history into our greater curriculums, we wouldn't need 1 month or 1 week from stemming from Carter G. Woodson's Negro mm-hmm. History Week that Black History Month came out of.
Mm-hmm.
Would it be just as discriminatory if we didn't incorporate the larger history?
I think that let me go back. The role of Black History Month, to me, in my understanding, is not to group off or segregate different histories of the United States. To me, it's always been about putting that history into American history, bringing it all together.
Right.
So I haven't really seen it as a way of, oh, we're pulling this, we're talking about one ethnic group versus the other. I mean, that's not what the goal of Black History Month is. The goal of Black History Month is to drive that narrative, African-American history, into the greater narrative of American history. That's what I would see. That's what I think it's about.
And is it because history is more local than a lot of people would be willing to admit that maybe Black History Month on a larger scale seems a little bit redundant and dry every single February where we
right.
see the same figures,
right.
Martin Luther King, Rosa Parks, maybe Frederick Douglass, throw in a George Washington Carver.
Right, right.
It has no local resonance. It's stuff
yeah.
we learn about over and over again on a cursory level, but there's nothing local. Talk about that.
Right. I think for me, Black History Month, that's the greatest time period, I think, to really talk about African-American history in your local communities. And that, I think, will make it more relevant for our younger people coming up and whoever may not feel that it's an important thing to discuss. But definitely looking at our own family history, going around to the churches in the community. I belong to a Paseo Baptist, but there are other churches in the area that do a lot of their own local history, talking about individuals in the different churches and the organizations, the NAACP chapters in the area, and really taking advantage of the time period to look at your own local history, I think will bring about, we'll make it more significant as we continue on. I think at times we do get tired of the same narrative that we hear every month. And also, you know, a lot of that narrative we hear is really cleansed of the details and the suffrage and the violence that happened. And as African-Americans search for full citizenship in this country, a lot of it's kind of scrubbed clean of all that. But if we bring that back and really look at what really happened and what's really happened in this narrative of African-American history in this country, we'll find that passion again and we'll find that those interesting points.
How does the Black Archives play a role in helping us dig into the details?
Well, definitely our collection will be available coming up as we go into the spring and into the summer for people to come and go through the inventory and look at the different items that we have that we've collected and that Horace Peter started collecting. And then as we continue to ask the community to come through and donate their papers and individual pieces as well. So we're definitely going to be that place to go to find those narratives that exist in this community.
We're talking Black Archives and Black History Month. The two are one and the same. Our guest is Doretha Williams, the new executive director of the Black Archives of Mid-America. Chris, you're on Central Standard.
Yes, I just wanted to make a quick comment. I think I'm a Caucasian, but that's irrelevant. I think that Black History Month is absolutely imperative. Only in my generation, and I'm a child of the 60s, have we begun to talk about what is real American history. I mean, we really don't talk about this country's founded on the genocide of Indians or on the backs of blood and murder of African Americans. Only now are we beginning to have an accurate view of history. So, and until the day comes that we have a true holistic approach to our history, we need to have these individual events to tell us who we really are. And it's not divisive. This is a country that is built on diversity. So it's important we know about all of our history, not just one view of it. So I'd like to take your comment off here. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Chris brings up a great point. And you mentioned earlier, Doretha, not sanitizing the history, but telling it like it is.
Right.
So we can learn lessons and go forward. How does the archives play a role in that? And what do you think about telling the whole tough story?
I think it's extremely important to tell the whole story, which is, I think, one reason why we don't see the importance sometimes anymore, because it has been kind of sanitized. But it's extremely important to know what exactly went on, and not just, you know, in general civil rights or what have you, but we need to understand, you know, what African-American women went through in time period, being enslaved and in this country, and those atrocities and that history. We need to know that the struggle was extremely difficult, and we're still struggling. I mean, it's not something that has gone away. I mean, the struggle is still going on. We are still fighting to be recognized as full citizens, and I mean, it's very important to make sure we tell that story and to say that the narrative is still developing. You know, I think a part of if those folks who think that it's not important anymore, they may think that the struggle's over. You know, we did it. It's we slave, we're free, civil rights. Okay, we're done. But that narrative still continues today, and that's that's the role that the Black Archives will play in the community.
And that tends to persist in our telling of the history. We're out of slavery. We got the Civil Rights Bill passed.
Right.
We have voting rights. We have a Black president.
Right.
We've done it.
Right.
How are you dispelling that? How are you beefing up the reality that it's still a struggle?
Oh, it's still a struggle. I mean, we can just look at the newspaper or correspondence. You know, wherever you see it, you still see negative images of African Americans, whether it's in your workplace or, you know, whether it's in politics. You know, we're still fighting images, negative images. We're still fighting hatred. We're still fighting problems, discrepancy in healthcare, discrepancies in education. So it's still there.
In that sense, are you now collecting modern images for later use?
Yes, we are. And that will happen as we continue to do our inventory and get our archives set up. We will be opening the doors for individuals to bring in new collections and actually have more modern pieces, more modern collections.
Our guest is Doretha Williams, the new executive director at the Black Archives of Mid-America. We're discussing her goals for the archives and the preservation of historical artifacts and historical facts in the region. Kansas City, today is the first day of Black History Month. How do you feel about Black History Month? 816-235-2888, 816-235-2888, or shoot us an email at centralstandard@kcur.org. After a quick break, we'll delve into the business of death, which in turn created life in the African-American community in the pre-Civil Rights era, with a look at the history of Black funeral homes in the region. We'll be right back. And welcome back to Central Standard. I'm Javelani LaFall. Preeminent African-American author Colson Whitehead used the term Magic Seven to describe the path to a life of prosperity among Black professionals in the days of segregation. The Magic Seven includes doctors, dentists, lawyers, preachers, teachers, nurses, and undertakers. Undertakers. And in this part of the hour, we'll discuss the seventh prosperous profession in Whitehead's imagined world of Black wealth, funeral directors, and funeral home owners, the economic downturn-proof business with its own unique history, particularly in the African-American community. And for that, joining us now is Lee Ward, owner of the Museum of Funeral History in Independence, who will give us a glimpse into the important historical footnote of Black life and death in the Kansas City region. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Now, before we get started and get into the historical aspects of Black funeral homes, why start a museum of funeral history? Give us some background on that, Mr. Ward.
Well, first of all, this is something that I have done for about 50 years. I've been an undertaker for 50 years, and I had collected for all of those 50 years, and I felt like this was artifacts that were disappearing. So I began this collection, and it has just kind of grown. A lot of the funeral homes here in the Kansas City area has added to it by calling me and have asked me to add to my collection. So that's how it all came about.
A funeral director was a position of high esteem in small towns in general, and the black community in particular in the pre-civil rights days. And tell us about the uniqueness of this profession and how it shapes our history.
In the black community?
In the black community, in the community in general. We're going to dial down into the black community.
Yes.
But in the community in general.
Especially in the black community, what you saw in the black community was it was held in such high esteem, along with the minister and the undertakers were two of the most esteemed members of the community. First of all, they were probably the only two members of the community that were allowed to wear suits all the time. And that was important. And they could literally wear them 7 days a week. And they were intertwined. Many times the undertaker was the minister. And so you saw this being in the community where these individuals were held in such high esteem in the community.
Now, some may ask the question as you walk into these black funeral homes to gather information and as you're giving this talk and this exhibit and these lectures on black funeral homes, why a white person would be interested in doing that?
Well,
it's fascinating, and it's a fascinating footnote.
It's a good question. It's a very good question. First of all, I'm passionate about it, and I felt like, number one, it was something that we were losing. We were losing the history of. When I started this museum, I felt like that I wanted there to be a part of my museum. There was a part that was missing, and the part that was missing was the part that incorporated black history in it. So the only way I was going to be able to do that was to get out into the community and find out about the black history. Well, when I went into the community to find out about it, I found out that there was not very much history in the community of the black funeral homes. So being the age that I am, I decided, you know, I was going to have to do this myself.
Is this why you call your lecture the send-off, the final send-off, African-American funeral homes? Do you feel both that there's a larger metaphor on the decline of the business as well as the actual business of death?
Yes. Yes, there is. For example, let me just give you a good example. In the 1950s, there were 30 black funeral homes in Kansas City. There are now 4 black funeral homes in Kansas City. And that's sad to think that we're seeing a demise of black funeral homes. And if we don't somehow or another historically preserve the history of these black funeral homes, it's going to be lost.
Lee Ward, based on what you know about funeral history and larger history of the region, do you think that it was, in fact, desegregation that cut into what was once a forced niche for black funeral homes? Do you think that had anything to do with a lot of them closing? We're now no longer living in a segregated society, so they were only serving black people.
Oh, I think that played a big part in it. I think, and that's what, whenever I talk about this, I talk about, first of all, how slavery itself played a big part in the differences between the funeral. I talk about how segregation played a part in the differences between the white funeral and the black funeral. And I think the desegregation and so forth. I think the way that the big corporations have come in and have bought up many of the funeral homes. All of this together is playing a big part in the demise of the funeral homes as we know it.
In that decline of black funeral homes in particular.
Correct.
All right. Well, since this is a historical discussion, let's go all the way back 150 years and then we'll bring it forward in the discussion. Let's go back to the days of slavery. Tell us about the vital rite of passage into the afterlife for black families that you discovered in your research.
Okay. Well, what I discovered, first of all, and one of the things that I'm going to bring out in my talk is that I'm going to start with the Civil War period because that's where we have to begin, because the embalming itself began in the Civil War. And I'm going to start with the primary person who was paramount in embalming, who was a black person.
Prince Greer. Who was that person?
Prince Greer.
Tell us about Prince Greer.
Prince Greer had two very important things about it. Number one, he was black. And secondly, he was from the South. And those two things combined together just didn't happen during the Civil War. All embalmers came from the North, except for Prince Greer. Prince Greer was a slave, and he learned to embalm from his master and went on to become a very actually, he was a very successful embalmer. And I'm going to show how – now, he did not come to the Kansas City area, but he was the catalyst that began the black history of embalming and began this as such. And that was he had a lot of obstacles that he had to overcome, and we're going to talk about that.
Well, tell us about the cultural differences in funeral homes and funeral directing – that came from the lineage of this Prince Greer character that you introduced us to as one of the first African-American embalmers in the country. Who are the Kansas City descendants of that?
Okay. Well, what I'm going to be talking to you about, first of all, in 1905, we're going to talk about one of the pioneers in the Kansas City area, which is Theron B. Watkins and also H.B. Moore. They were pioneers in this area.
Well, tell us about T.B. Watkins now.
T.B. Watkins. T.B. Watkins was a pioneer here in Kansas City, opened one of the first funeral homes here. T.B. Watkins and his family still is here, and his granddaughter still is in Kansas City here. And T.B. Watkins began on Lydia Street here in Kansas City and is well, I would say he was almost the granddaddy of the black funeral homes here. And you're going to hear a lot about him. I'm going to talk a lot about T.B.
Well, talk a lot about T.B. now. What type of man was he? Give us a primer for what you're going to discuss. Discuss it here.
Oh, okay.
Tell us about it right now.
All right. You want me to give my talk for you now.
You keep saying you're going to talk about it. Talk about it right now. You're live on the radio.
All right. So, in other words, you want my little preview. So, all right. Well, T.B. Went to school at he was one of the first he came from Carthage, Indiana, first of all, and worked for the Pullman Company. And then he began to – he worked for a white undertaker by the name of Raymond Johnson. And then he went to the Cincinnati School of Embalming. And then he opened the Watkins Brothers funeral home at 17th and Lydia here in Kansas City. And his brother died in 1917. But T.B. established himself as one of the pioneer black funeral homes here in Kansas City. Actually, he became a very powerful force here in Kansas City, not only in the business world, but also in the political world.
He did. His name is all over the
place.
His surname is all over the place.
His son is very familiar, Bruce Watkins. And that's we all know Bruce Watkins as his son. He served three terms as Grand Master for the Odd Fellows. T.B. did as the Odd Fellows of Missouri. He was very active in the Golden Gloves boxing matches, and he was a man that was extremely active in the field of community service. And I think he's a gentleman that Kansas City owes a big debt to.
You're listening to Central Standard on 89.3 KCUR and streaming live on KCUR.org. Our guest is Lee Ward, owner of the Museum of Funeral History and Independence. And we're talking about right now the history of black funeral homes in the region as an important historical footnote for black life and death in the Metro. His presentation at the Kansas City Public Library on the evening of February 7th is titled The Final Send-Off, African-American Funeral Homes. We talked about T.B. Watkins and his legacy. What does it say about the Kansas City Metro area and its legacy of segregation that a funeral home director was able to wield so much power and be so successful in a segregated community and raise above, transcend his profession to become a larger community leader?
Well, I think it says a lot about it, about the power, and I use that word in quotes, so to speak, that he was able to give to this community. I think he was respected. He was outside of the black community because he would not have been able to do what he did. It had to go beyond the black community. He was a respected man outside
in
the
general.
Black community. In general, he absolutely was. And I think you'll see this whenever I present this.
Well, tell us about these other luminaries in the funeral home business, Adkins, Kerford, and H.B. Moore.
Okay.
What do you know about them?
Well, Mr. Kerford, I cannot talk about black history without talking about Mr. Kerford because especially Charles Kerford is still living, and I had the privilege of being able to interview him. He is the only living person left here in Kansas City.
What type of man is he? How did he strike you?
Oh, absolutely fantastic. He is a Tuskegee Airman. He lives here in Kansas City. He's 92 years old. He was with these men. It was like I was stepping back in history whenever I got to interview him and his wife, Ruth. It was such a privilege to be able to be with him.
What were some of the more compelling stories of Mr. Kerford?
Well, he owned the Sarah Adkins Funeral Home, the Sarah Adkins Mansion. It was the Kerford Funeral Home. And for many, many years, he owned that. The thing that struck me the most was that the fact that black obituaries were not able to be put into the Kansas City Star until 1963. They were not able to be published. The Call was the only paper that you could put black obituaries in until 1963.
And presumably, these black funeral homes were the only coffins and mortuaries that you could put black bodies in as well.
That's right.
In the same era.
Now, white funeral homes would embalm the bodies, but they would sneak them in the back door many times. They would be taken in through the basement. They would be embalmed, and then they would be brought out through the basement and taken to the home, casketed, and so forth. So it was all done in secret because a lot of the white funeral homes did not want to be known as doing black funerals. It was a stigma attached to it if you got yourself known as doing black funerals.
Segregation even in death, so to
speak. Oh, yes, absolutely.
We have a caller in this part of the hour that wants to share a memory about the black funeral homes.
Okay.
Joe Maddox, welcome to Central Standard.
Yes. I'm very sorry that I'm not going to be able to attend this lecture. I really wanted to, some people know me as a historian, and I had gathered some information about more information than I had given your guests about African-American funeral homes. Mm-hmm. But let me say that I'm old enough to know that living in the South, where there were no black funeral homes, we used to have wakes where the body would be placed in one of the rooms in the home, and everybody would stay there overnight to guard or to stay awake while the person was going to be buried the next day. But also, it's interesting, in Kansas City, there was a film director by the name of Mrs. Meeks, and she marketed her business with pink Cadillacs, and at that time,
yes,
that was really outstanding. I mean, most funeral homes had black, and she had pink Cadillacs, and that was sort of outstanding for Kansas City.
Joe Maddox, what is unique about the black funeral home experience and the profession of undertaker in African-American history as we look at it panoramically?
Well, as your guest has mentioned, I mean, there was some of the most respected people in the community. They had something natural about them of being very kind, and in that need, they just could make you feel better about the whole situation of death along with the ministers. But also, black funeral homes were some of the most beautiful places to visit, you know, in the black community. It seemed like, you know, they had everything more than and many people, and you didn't enjoy going, but you always looked around to see how nice everything was.
Thank you very much, Joe, for your comments on that. Deborah writes, in perpetuity, essentially, the first funeral custom was found with the grave of Neanderthal with flowers in it, which shows society has been mourning for thousands of years. Now, that's the premise of your funeral home museum, to show the death rituals of mankind in general. But
right.
What was unique about the black process versus the white process in this region, in Kansas City, Lee Ward?
Right. The difference between the funerals, is that what
right.
you mean?
The funerals right. and the funeral process.
Right. Well, there is a big difference, and I discovered that not only from my experience, but as I delved into looking at this. First of all, from something so simple as the length of the funeral, and we were talking about that earlier today. Many of the black funerals, you're going to expect a two-hour funeral is not uncommon. And if you would tell a white person that you're going to sit for 2 hours through a funeral, they would roll their eyes clear to the back of their head. That's just what they would do. They would go, and many times I do lots of funerals. I do a lot of celebration of life funerals. I'm trained as a celebrant. And one of the things I ask families is, how long do you expect this funeral to last? And most white people will say, 45 minutes.
Wow.
Well, I say to a lot of times in the black culture, there, some of the songs last that long.
Some of the
know.
Songs
yeah,
last about 2 hours.
Last that long. So there's one difference. And there are just so many differences in the black funeral and the white funeral, from the folders, from the funeral folders to the dress.
Well, tell us about the funeral folders. Tell us about some of the artifacts in the collection that come from the local black funeral homes that are no longer in business that you are exhibiting.
And I'm going to have an exhibit of things. In the funeral folders is a great example of this. In the white culture, we have those little bifold funeral folders. I was just amazed at the black funeral folders. Of course, I knew those existed because I've done black funerals. But as I really got into them, they are beautiful. They're absolutely beautiful. They're like books.
Right.
They're books. Bound booklets. And they are historical. They have complete obituaries in them. They're full of pictures. They are rich in history. I can pick up, and I have in my collection well over 5,000 funeral folders, alphabetized, and I can pick up any one of those and tell you about this person just by looking at this funeral folder, and it just amazes me at the richness that goes into these.
You've talked about and are going to talk about, as you specified on the show, T.B. Watkins, Mr. Atkins, Mr. Kerford, and H.B. Moore. Are these the only four active funeral homes still left?
No, none of those funeral homes are still active.
None of those are still active, but those are the collections that
no.
you have.
No, those are Watkins is the only one that is still active
out of these
four. Yes, there were four funeral homes at the turn of the 1900s in Kansas City, Watkins, Conti, Moore, and Atkins. And none of those are left except Watkins is the only ones that are left now. Now, today you have Lawrence A. Jones, Ely, Harvey, and DeLete.
And what are those still doing in business? Have you check with them?
Oh, yeah. Yes. I have with, I have been in all four of them, except for one. I have not been in one of them that I was not able to get it. It didn't work out for me to get in with one of them. But, for example, Dwayne Harvey, I was interviewed him. He's a wonderful person. He gave me a lot of rich history. So I have been able to talk with all of them.
What rich history did he give you?
Well, first of all, you have to understand they're all a lot younger than myself.
Right.
So I was able to give them some history too. But the historical fact of where they worked at and what they came out of, you know, and where they started from. And they don't go back too far because they're younger men, every one of them.
What exactly did you learn?
Well, I learned that they started the same way that I did, which was washing cars and mowing yards. And
at the funeral homes.
At the funeral homes. That's how. And again, Mr. Kerford was really the only one that's left that could give me historical facts back to these early pioneers of history.
What did Mr. Kerford give to you that gives you a sense of what's changed with black funeral homes?
Oh gosh, the everything that he's given me, that every word out of his mouth was mind-boggling to me, because the changes are just so so different today.
Was there a specific word that came out of his mouth that struck you?
It's so hard to pin down. I can't really think of anything because everything was so. I was so mind boggled by everything that he told me that it's hard for me to pin down anything.
So enthralling that it's hard for
it
you
was,
to remember.
It was. I absolutely, you know, I kind of just sat there with my mouth agape to think I was talking, first of all, to a Tuskegee Airman.
Right.
And then to this man that had roots with these pioneers. And I'm taking notes so fast with him that he's it. When he's gone, that's the end of it.
Our guest is Lee Ward, owner of the Museum of Funeral History and Independence. And we were talking about the history of black funeral homes in the region, from Tuskegee Airmen to entrepreneurs in the field of funeral services. His presentation at the Kansas City Public Library on the evening of February 7th is titled "The Final Send-Off, African-American Funeral Homes." Thank you, Mr. Ward, for coming. And tune in tomorrow as we take you into the fast-paced world of female race car drivers. Central Standard is produced by Andrea Salenzi. UpToDate is next with presidential historian Doris Kearns Goodwin. I'm Jabalani LaFall. This is Central Standard. Enjoy your day.